Good afternoon. We're going to open up the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government. Today is May 11th, 2017. Good afternoon, colleagues. And so we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 5535, Department of Revenue. John, what do we need to know today?
Mr. Co-Chair and members of the subcommittee, the Department of Revenue is here with their vacant position report and discussion. Then they will follow it up by the agency reductions that were in the governor's budget and other budget, post-governor's budget, budget adjustments. And then the director will make a few closing remarks to the committee, and this will then conclude the their phase two hearings after this afternoon, Mr. Co-Chair.
Perfect. Thank you. So, Madam Director, I assume we're going to have Chris and Sean come up first. Is that what we want? Okay. Come on up. You'll introduce yourself for the record. We'll turn this over to you and we'll let you get started.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the subcommittee. I'm Chris Couts, the Deputy Director for the Oregon Department of Revenue.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Sean Waite, and I am the Administrative Services Division Administrator for the Department of Revenue.
So, is it Chair Smith today or Chair Manning?
Chair Smith.
First, before we get started on the vacancy report, I did not answer Representative Gomberg yesterday correctly on one of the questions that you had, and so I would like to correct my mistake for the record, if that's all right. You asked me yesterday about our cost of funds issue and the revenue collection KPM, that if we had hired the 30 more staff and revenue went up, would the cost of funds go down? And I did not answer that question correctly. The answer is yes, it would, more than likely. If you had additional revenue generation, then the cost of funds would go down.
So just to be clear, Mr. Chairman, if I might, so it was a two-part question. And the first part was that that we're showing the cost for each dollar that we are retrieving. And my first question was whether the vacant positions were factored into that cost since those vacancies were budgeted. You said yes to that.
And that was correct answer.
And then the second part of the question was that if we had more people collecting,
right,
more people who we already paid for, if those people were out collecting, would our cost per dollar go down? And your answer is most likely yes.
Yes, correct.
Right, which makes sense to me.
Yeah. Right. And now that I look back on it, it makes sense to me as well. So thank you for allowing me to
correct. Thank you for that clarification.
So with that, we are going to go to the vacancy report that you have. This is, I believe, posted on OLIS as well for members of the subcommittee. So it's no surprise. You have heard through the various division presentations and from the director that we have a number of vacancies in our organization. So first and foremost, we have 1,087 authorized positions in our organization. We currently have 175 vacancies. We do a combination. TWA stands for temporary work assignment. So that's when we have a workload increase and we need somebody to step in. That is internal. So you may have a staff person who is normally a revenue agent, and we might ask them to go work in our suspense unit for a while at an administrative specialist too. And if we did that, we would call that a temporary workload assignment to handle the workload that's coming through the suspense unit at the time. We also have a number of work out of class assignments. We have 91 of those. Work out of class is when we ask somebody to do a, it's very similar to a workload assignment, but more than likely it's to handle something different in the department. So a great example was the one that Director Ray talked about yesterday. As you know, we have, with a lot of discussion from this group about our collections, have asked Deanna Mack to step up and really spearhead the whole notion of a two-prong approach of looking at collections overall. One, what processes can we do to further streamline and implement the core system replacement project to utilize the automation to its fullest? And secondly, to develop a potential plan for further consideration by this body probably in the annual session next year, of creating a collections division, which would streamline all of our collections functions. Right now, as you know, our divisions are set up by customer versus by function. So this would be a blending. So that would give you a workout of class assignment opportunity. We've talked about double fills before. We have 43 double fills inside of the organization. That is where, again, as I explained, you have one position, but you have two people sitting on top of it. Of course, we have a number of lead worker positions inside of our organization. We traditionally use these to augment the ability for staff to have someone to go to answer technical questions, to help with work assignments, to provide some feedback to the actual supervisor about how staff is doing on their day-to-day work. So we use those in pretty much all of our collections units. We use them in our processing center units. It's a very common practice we have to help augment that type of work. Seasonal eligibility differential. That's a new differential that came out of the collective bargaining agreement this year. And so no surprise that the majority of that has gone to Administrative Services Division in our processing center, where we do hire seasonals every year for the tax processing season. The next one over is the bilingual differential. No surprise that we do try to hire people that have various language capabilities in order to serve the taxpayers that we have.
Let me ask a question on that. Is that challenging to find someone with the skill set you need who's also bilingual?
Chair Smith, I don't believe we've had a lot of problems hiring someone who has bilingual abilities, capabilities, especially for our public service representatives and our revenue agents. It hasn't come to my attention that that's been a problem in the past.
Which languages? I'm assuming Spanish.
Yes.
Are there what other languages?
For the most part, Chair Smith, it is Spanish. I don't believe we have specifically posted for other languages such as Russian or some of the others that you might expect. Uh-huh. For the most part, it is Spanish.
Got it. Thank you.
Then team lead differential. This is slightly different than lead worker differential. Most of this happens in the information technology arena, where these folks do a lot more of the technology work. It's specifically outlined in our collective bargaining agreement. You see it both in administrative services, because that's where our IT is budgeted in. You also see it in core system replacement, because we have a technical team assigned, an IT technical team assigned to the core system replacement project. So they have team lead differential there as well. And then last, you have lateral differential allowance. This is for people who are in the same salary range but are doing work at a different classification level. Again, these aren't significant pay differential issues. So they might be cents on a dollar. They might be a percentage of pay, that kind of thing. But they do not amount to significant amounts of pay, but enough to reflect that they need additional skills in order to do the job that we've hired them to do. And most of these, everything from this lateral differential allowance, team lead, bilingual, seasonal eligibility differential, even lead work, all of that, even work out of class, all of that type of thing is governed by the collective bargaining agreement that we have with SEIU, who represents the staff inside of our organization.
So let me ask this question. On the 16% vacancies, the 175 positions, which of those 175, which ones need to be recategorized, which ones can go away, and which ones we just got to fill?
So, Chairs,
maybe you want to put a plan together and bring it to us, because
yeah.
Obviously, rather than asking me to address
Chair Smith, my brain was going through how am I going to answer his question.
Yeah.
So that really is about planning. As we've talked about, we have some ideas where some of our staff, and we have moved some of the staff in order to reflect where workload has shifted inside of our organization. Also, we know that some things haven't settled out in our organization that we are still reviewing to determine what is the best work. And then I think we have certainly heard loud and clear from a number of different parties in the executive branch and the legislative branch that revenue collection and enforcement is high on people's priority list, and so those would be on the list as well. So, I think when you talk about revenue agents and tax auditors, that's pretty straightforward. When you get into some of this other stuff, that's where the question is, you know, at what level, where did work shift to, what would that look like in the end, that kind of thing. So
I guess what we would ask is, can you folks put your plan together of what your thoughts are on those vacancies and get that to John? So that way we can see, again, which positions need to be moved, which positions need to be refigured, which ones need to be eliminated, so that way we know how to proceed forward. Because obviously, in good conscience, we can't just leave 175 vacant positions and
sure.
say all is well.
Sure.
We can't do that. So no. You've got to give us the plan so John can analyze it and we can consider that.
Sure.
Okay. I'm going to go to Representative Marsh and I'll come to Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Chair. To what extent were any of the vacancies built into your baseline budget? I mean, are these long-term vacancies? Did you assume that all of these positions would be contained and maintained in the same place that they are now? Or
Chair Smith, Representative Marsh, we don't build in vacancies in our budgeting process.
I'm sorry. Let me rephrase that.
Okay.
I meant positions. The positions that are now represented as being vacant, are all of those positions built into the budget?
Yes.
We've assumed that all of those positions stay where they are.
Right now, yes. And then the plan that he was talking about would talk about where would they either shift within the division, within classification, or potentially between divisions and between classifications.
Okay, so none of that was reflected in the budget?
No, not at that time, because when we developed the budget over a year ago, we had just come out of one rollout and we're getting ready to go into another rollout. So a lot of our processes still weren't sorted out and sorted through.
Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and good afternoon.
Yes.
I've been pondering this report a little bit. We started out the week talking about the fact that we estimated there were roughly 100 vacancies in the department, and I'm sure the reaction to this committee is still fresh in your mind to that number, and now we're seeing it's actually 175. We see a lot of budgets, some of us serving on a couple of different subcommittees. I don't recall seeing an agency of this size with 16% vacancy rate. So my first question to you today is, I had heard from the director that nobody was fired to create these vacancies, so I want to make sure I understand whether this is normal attrition or whether this might reflect a morale problem or something else systemic within the department when we have this many vacancies. Let me start with this. Is that typical, 15% of the people leaving?
Chair Smith, Representative Gomberg, it is not. Our organization, I believe, has a typical turnover rate of about 5 to 7%. It is much higher now, but there's a reason for that, Representative. The leadership team made a choice back in December when the governor's budget came out, knowing that the governor's budget had over 100 position reductions. There were over 100 positions eliminated in the budget, to start holding vacancies inside of our organization to plan for a potential reduction of that number of positions to ease a layoff process. So when we now have had vacancies inside of our organization, we haven't filled them. We haven't actively recruited inside of our organization since about Well, right around December. We had actually revenue agents and auditors that had come in and interviewed, and we asked the program managers to wait until we got the governor's budget. And when the governor's budget came out at the level it came out, then we asked them not to offer employment to those people because it's last in, first out from a reduction standpoint. Also, in that we did work with labor to say these are the choices we have. We can continue to hire people knowing that we may have a potential layoff to occur, or we can hold vacancies so that people have a place to land in the end. So that was, and the other piece of that too is that if there was going to be that level of reductions inside of our organization, our program managers needed to start looking at how they were going to do business differently in order to accommodate a less number of position workforce. I missed a word in there and I can't figure out what it is.
Isn't it fair to say, and I'll
please.
Call, isn't it fair just to say, you just have too many positions? I mean, let's just cut to the chase on this. We just have too many positions, and we just need to figure out what's the correct staffing level for the department.
So, Chair Smith, I think what we're really struggling with inside of the organization is what is the best plan for the positions that we are authorized in order to do the work that we have with the new business processes that we have implemented.
But what
implemented.
I hear you saying then is you're going to create a plan to use all the positions rather than here's what we need to do and here's the positions we need.
So Representative Smith, I believe you just asked me to put together a plan that would show which positions to eliminate, which positions to potentially shift or reclassify, or which positions to hire. In that plan, it would assume that some of these 175 go away, yes.
Okay, that's what I wanted to hear. Thank you. I'm going to come to Representative Gumbring, and I'll come to Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And your point is well taken, although I would say that that the question of whether there's too many positions would depend on which subdivision we're looking at, because there's some parts of this department that seem to be challenged in getting some of the overall mission accomplished.
Most definitely.
So let me jump ahead to the double fills. And I'm reading the policies that dictate how and when you can double fill for leave, for transition, for an established position, for budget issues, for job share. With the 43 double fills that we've got right here, is there any of those categories that we're using more often? I mean, big picture, what's going on with the double fills?
So, Chair Smith and Representative Gomberg, it's a real mix. It is everything from planning for transition of staff so that managers can do the knowledge transfer. When we know a retirement is coming up, for example, and we hire somebody in behind them to do that knowledge transfer, we do it in order to anticipate turnover in our organization, and we hire, like, say we might have 10 revenue agent vacancy, but we go out and we hire 15, knowing that because of the volume of those positions inside of our organization, that the turnover will occur in the next 6 months. And so might as well bring on a whole class at one time rather than doing one-off hiring, as an example. We also use double fills, as I talked about, in this season to handle some workload for the tax services unit. And we do have people out on medical leave that we hire behind because we do have long-term medical leave issues inside of our organization where people can be out for over a year.
Mr. Chairman, just one last follow-up. And the answer to this question, I know what the answer to the question is, but I want to get the question on the record.
Okay.
All of our double fills were done according to the policies that are in place.
Chair Smith, Representative Gomberg, yes.
Right, thank you.
I'm going to go Representative Nierman now. Come. I apologize.
Good. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, excuse me. When you have seasonal work, you don't really have a good way to budget for those positions, do you? I mean, you don't have a, there's not really a thing to say, I need a guy from April to July whatever, you have to get one FTE assigned. No? So tell me about how do you deal with
Chair that? Smith, Representative Nierman, the budget system and the position inventory control systems actually allow for seasonal positions and for the length of time that they're needed in any given year. So there's a special classification that you can use within the systems, budget to it, budget for the number of months needed each year. So we budget in the processing center for tax processing season. And those positions are generally budgeted depending between 4 to 6 months, depending on the types of positions. And so they don't, so they then would only have maybe a half FTE associated with them because you only need 6 months every year versus 12 months every year.
And you call that a limited duration position?
No, limited duration is different than seasonal. Seasonal is its own classification because it's an ongoing workload that you know will keep coming back year after year. Limited duration is usually used more for project-based work where you know you have a project that will come in and you get the work done and then the work's done and you let the staff go.
Thank you.
Senator Johnson.
I guess I'm struggling the same way that Representative Gomberg is. I think that there is a mythology in this building that any contraction of the Department of Revenue workforce will reflect negatively on revenue collection. The reality, as I have observed it through the last 2 weeks, is that we provided you more positions and you didn't fill them. And I know you have a new director, and I know that she went through a period of assessment or is doing that now. But what I haven't heard is a sense of urgency. I've heard you, through your testimony, talk about needing to plan, needing to review, needing to think about. What some of us are really struggling with is, where's the needing to do? I have no idea how long some of this projected reflection and thoughtful introspection is going to take. And to me, the barn's on fire. Somebody needs to call 911. And Ms. Couts, bless your heart, I listened to the kind of 100,000-foot platitudes, and I want to know, where's the plan? What are you going to do? How long are you going to think about this stuff? When is there action? And I don't know what tools this committee has in their toolbox to enforce that discipline. In my opinion, this cannot drift longer. I consider this a crisis at this point. And when you did use some of the money that we gave you for revenue collection, you yielded bountiful results. And yet I don't understand why you wouldn't have put the full court press on hiring folks to do that work. And I just don't buy the argument that they're not out there. I just simply don't buy it. They maybe are not trained as accountants, but you can go and find sentient beings and teach them to do just about anything. I just don't buy the dog ate my homework. And I'm sorry, but I don't know what suggestions the co-chairs are amenable to, but I can tell you when we had other troubled agencies, they ended up with a partial budget. A half a biennium. Now, I'm not here to tell you that that was productive because it's been 6 years that I've been grinding on the library and don't really see a giant amount of improvement there. But we got to do something to help motivate you guys to understand we got a problem.
So here's, Senator, appreciate these thoughts, most definitely. So I've had an opportunity, John and the co-chair, and I've had an opportunity to visit with staff from the governor's office, and right now they're working with the department to bring a framework of a plan to us that we are going to review and then allow them to work between now and September to bring that plan forward to present to us during the interim.
In the meantime,
we're having conversations with the co-chairs about how best to keep an element of control over this budget. So there are some conversations that are occurring on this.
That's very comforting. The one thing I might add that you and I spent quite a bit of time together in discussing cost containment, and rooting out these vacancies is a cornerstone of that being successful. And it's not just you guys. I mean, you happen to have the most glaring example, but I'm always aware of the fact that agencies hoard vacancies, they burn them, they use them in all sorts of different ways. But the amount of your vacancies is so startling that I think it's left even those of us that are seasoned doing this with our jaws on the table trying to figure out what's systemically wrong here. Something is not right.
So let's get through today. Let the executive branch and the department come back to us here in the coming days with what their plan will be to work through this between now and September, and then each of us will have a chance to review it and get our comments in.
Cool. I'm sorry that my eyes kept averting yours when we were not making eye contact. It's because I'm looking at the machine over your shoulder.
I'm dying to turn this way as
fascinated
well.
Fascinated by it.
All right, so let's continue forward.
There's no shortage of employees working on that project, by the way, Mr. Chair.
So let's continue forward. We have 1 hour remaining. Yeah.
So, Chair Smith and members of the subcommittee, what I'm going to do here is walk through the reductions that are included in the governor's budget for our organization, and also some of the policy option packages that got included as well. It's just kind of a point of reference as you make final decisions for our organization, kind of what we have on our plate right now. So in administration, so this is a combination when we talk about administration. This is really the executive division, which includes the director's office, human resources, and communications. You see a reduction of 5 positions here. These are mostly, there's 1 internal audit position as well as 4 support positions inside there.
Mr. Chair,
yeah,
I guess the difficulty I have is in looking at the disparate nature of those functions. Communications. I don't know how many people you have in your communications section. I don't know what they do. Are they internal communications? Are they external? Are they your government affairs guys over here trying to get your budget passed? Who are they and what do they do? When I see internal audit next to that for a fiscal agency that already has shortages in competent accountants, that scares me. I don't know on the HR. Can you buy any of those other services from somebody else? The point that I'm making here is you list these as reductions. I'm wondering whether best business practices suggest you don't have those functions. Agency operations, I don't know what that means. And so these are just kind of words up there without seeing them in a context.
So, Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, then I'm not going to meet your need today because this is how I've laid out the presentation.
Okay, let's just call it a draw then.
Okay. I can speak more specifically, but what I'm concerned about, like what's going through my head right now, Senator Johnson, is the fact that I can't remember if it's 7 positions in communications or 8 positions in communications. I can't remember if it's 22 positions in HR or what. And so to break this down to give you a sense of what the reduction is against, that's tough.
Mr. Chair?
Please.
And the more you talk, the deeper the hole gets. What do 22 people in communications do? You don't seem to, are those all filled or are those vacant?
Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, the 22 positions were in human resources, and human resources includes not only traditional human resources, but our disclosure office as well as our facilities unit.
And do you count those as communication?
No.
How many people are in communication?
Either 7 or 8.
Okay, then I'll rephrase my question. What do 7 or 8 people do in communications?
Chair Smith, Senator Johnson. So we have, I think it's over 600 forms and publications that we do every year on behalf of taxpayers for our personal income tax, business tax, and property taxes. So those folks have to update forms and instructions every year, as well as they are our public affairs officers, as well as a communications manager to oversee those folks. So that's the type of work that they do.
I guess, Chris, I'm so sorry to keep badgering you about this, but So you do the forms. Somebody tells you how to do them. You stick them in the computer and they pump out. The people aren't hand doing them. I mean,
Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, they are the ones that design them. Many times after legislative sessions, we have new lines we have to add to our forms. The credits change, what's eligible for, the instructions change every year. It is that is the type of work that they do. And when you have over 600 of them and they have to be updated every season, it's just like we have to work with the software companies every season to ensure that our forms can be read by the various equipment that we have, that they can interact with the software companies as well to ensure that we get the data back as they put the forms through.
One last shot. We've just spent I don't know how many million dollars on a new system, and I can't believe that it needs to be modified to be compatible with your forms, or maybe I didn't hear you correctly.
Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, so the Gentax or core system replacement is the back-end processing system. When we talk about the processing center modernization, that's the front end that reads the forms, and that is one of our policy option packages here today.
So let's get to the next hour, and then we'll go from there. Okay. So please continue.
If you can move to administration. So the next in administration here is both our general services division as well as our project management office. You see a reduction of four positions and three FTE there. The reason the FTE looks a little funky there is because the four positions are eliminated for 18 months out of our project management office. We have used the project management office as the way to ensure that our core systems replacement project has gone well by having the project manager, the project director, and that type of thing. So it is of concern to us as we look at bringing on other projects that this was part of the reduction that was included in our budget as we look to property valuation, processing center modernization, and that type of thing. Administration here is for the administrative services division. So this is a combination of all areas that Sean talked about, which includes processing center, accounting, budget, procurement, payroll, as well as our information technology services. That is all in this particular reduction. You can see 42 positions and 34.6 FTE. The volume of those, a large part of those are in our processing center. Because there is a large number of staff associated with the processing center in relationship overall to this budget. There are also positions in accounting that are on the list and in budget. So, as well as information technology services, especially in the service desk and service support areas. We have seen in information technology the service desk support growth needs, largely due to handling tickets that come through for access to our Gentax system, as well as concerns that we have had about the state's new telephone system. Hopefully, the state's telephone system issues are temporary and not long-term.
Thank you,
yes,
Mr. Chair.
Replaced.
Just as long as the phone system was up there, do you have the new phone system yet?
Chair Smith, Senator DeBoer, we do, I think, except for all of our two field offices. So the majority of our, about, I would say, 900 to 940 of our staff have the new phone system, and about 60 do not.
Is it working?
Chair Smith, Senator DeBoer, we have had significant issues with the new phone system. I have personally, along with the staff that are project managing it out of our information technology services, worked with DAS very closely to make the vendor aware of the issues we've had and that we continue to have with the new phone system. For us, mostly, it is dropped calls, which is of concern when you have a taxpayer on the line that they can't get the service they need.
please.
It would be lovely if we could get a report back from when that work stoppage is going to conclude on the phone system.
That would be perfect. Thank you. Is that all right, John? Got it. All right, let's continue.
Okay, so then within administration, there are some changes in the budget that also reflect just maybe some policy changes as well. We reflect a transfer out of our organization, not to the Common School Fund, but to the Department of Education and the State School Fund for marijuana tax changes, the distribution. We would like to move the research unit, the funding and the positions for the research unit, to the director's office. And you will see the bottom part there is a reduction of about just over $1.2 million, almost $1.3 million in general fund and other fund limitation that was taken out at legislative direction of our base budget for the Processing Center Life Cycle Project. That was the one that reflects the one that failed that we have discussed here a couple of different times. If we go to the next page, we talk about things that were added back in administration in the governor's budget. So package 102 incorporates things that we will need after project implementation for the go forward. Bonding cannot pay for the state data center charges that we have associated with the project. We have received general fund for this in the past, and we need an additional $2 million to keep the servers and whatnot running that support the software associated with Gentax. We also have the $1.8 million. Our CIO, Mr. Johnson, talked quite a bit about this reflects service level 2 inside of the governor's budget at $1.8 million. And we talked about the differences between the service level at 2 or tier 3 service level. Then there was also policy option package 112, which is processing center. This was called life cycle, but we have renamed it now to modernization in the last couple of months. What this almost $652,000, as well as the other fund limitation associated with it, is for the maintenance and support of the systems we have in place right now until a new project could get up and running. So this is only to keep what we have going. It isn't to do anything new. So property tax, there should be no surprises there, as Sean went through most of this information on Monday in relationship to the reductions in property tax. These figures are the same. You see the $1.8 million other fund limitation reduction. A lot of that is related, about $1 million of that was empty limitation, if you'll recall, inside property tax division, as well as the reduction for the CAFA program and the positions associated with CAFA funding and the valuation program that it runs. We've talked quite a bit about the impact of not having those appraisers and what that means to future appraisals, their ability to get through a good appeal, and the roles at the local level for the property tax system. Personal income tax and compliance section. So this, as if you'll recall Joanne's testimony, I think in phase one and even in phase two, this reflects a 10% reduction out of the personal income tax and compliance program with the 41 positions and 39.5 FTE. She does have roughly 420 positions, I think, allocated to her division. So with that, this reduction in the governor's budget reflects across all program areas. So it is a combination of positions everywhere from suspense to revenue agents to tax auditors. There's support staff included in there, filing enforcement staff. So it is across all of those types of positions. We've talked, and you have commented, And we have talked about a lot the impact that that is having to revenue generation. I think there is still the challenge of what is the right level of positions in order to achieve what you want to achieve and balance that against some of the automation efficiencies that we have found. Next, for personal income tax and compliance, we did phase out $361,000 of general fund. If you'll recall, for those of you that were here last session, you gave us a policy option package that incorporated this dollar figure to work with the employment department to do real-time withholding match. It was one-time money that has phased out of our budget for next biennium. So the business division, so there was a total of $2.6 million reduced out of the business division. It's actually a combination, while the net is eight positions, it was really a total of 14 mostly general fund positions with the add back of six other fund positions for the other agency accounts. The 14 positions that were reduced were again across the board, much like they were in personal income tax and compliance. They reflect filing enforcement auditors and compliance specialists and revenue agents, as well as support staff. No surprise, in the business division, we are phasing out one-time costs associated with bringing up the marijuana tax administration program from last biennium to this biennium, as well as we have asked for additional other fund limitation to reflect the ongoing costs with the contract we have with the state police for $164,000. So other actions that are included in the governor's recommended budget, you see here a phasing out of $1.5 million in elderly rental assistance. If you'll recall, that program has now shifted and those general funds went into the housing and community services budget, I believe. Is that correct, Sean? Or is this the reduction in the number of people eligible for the program?
This is actually to reflect the caseload that we have in that program.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mr. Pitcher.
Yeah. What was that again? You're phasing out.
It's for caseload.
Yep.
John, can you give us a little background on this?
If I may, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, and Sean, you can please correct me if I'm wrong, or Patrick. The $1.5 million reflects a statutory change last session. I believe it was Senate Bill 296, which transferred this program from the Department of Revenue to Housing and Community Services. Okay. There is a second adjustment in this program within the budget that I think Chris will speak to, and that is another caseload adjustment. Mm-hmm. But the 1.5 here reflects a statutory change again from last session.
Okay, so it's just moving caseload, right? From Department of Revenue to another agency.
Right.
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair.
Okay.
Do you want to give the committee just a little more background on this?
Yeah. So
on the same page.
This program unit has two programs in it. One was elderly rental assistance, and that was literally a cash distribution to people who met certain criteria to help with their rental income. And the program, or lack of program, was literally a payment. If you qualified, we sent money. There was no efficacy to the program. There was no evaluation done. Did it help? Did it not help? So we worked over the course of the last couple of years with Housing and Community Services and many of the people in this building to actually transfer that money into Housing and Community Services budget, where they have more active programs for seniors in order to ensure the money can be used for the things that are really what they need.
Okay.
And to get them that program.
That makes sense to me.
The other part of this that we actually don't have a bullet here, but I will talk about, is the nonprofit home program. So we provide tax payments for those that have qualifying nonprofit homes. The state provides general fund directly to the counties to pay the taxes for those that qualify for an exemption because they run a nonprofit home. That caseload has also been changing, and there is about a $1.1 million general fund reduction because we aren't making the number of tax payments that we have in the past.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Sandra. What kind of not-for-profit home?
Boy, Chair Smith and Senator Johnson, I wish I had the answer to that question. We'll have to get back to you on that. Do you know, Patrick?
Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. Senator Johnson, the nonprofit homes for the elderly are intended to provide services to senior citizens.
Yes.
And low-income senior citizens.
Can you identify yourself?
Yeah. I'm sorry. My name for the record is Patrick Heath.
Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, we'll get you the eligibility of what it takes to be a nonprofit home and who qualifies for that. You have also heard us talk about the core system replacement project. This is the last part of the project funding itself to finish out implementation of the final phase of the project. The $1 million in general fund is for maintenance and support in the first year. $9.5 million was included in the governor's budget. This would be the bond funding for the last phase of the project and the debt service of $1.7 million to go with that. We have been working with LFO and DAS to take a look at what it will take to close out that project in the next biennium. And we believe that the number will significantly reduce down to about $5.4 million other fund and in the ballpark of about $262,000 in general fund for debt service support. The reason for the large drop, I don't want you to think that we're skimping out on rollout 4 to finish out the project, is that we have over $3 million in contingency funds that we do not need bond funding for going forward because the project simply we do not believe will require that level of contingency funding. Next, we have the policy option package for the property valuation system. In the governor's budget, we had $4.3 million associated with the project going forward, as well as debt service costs of $820,000. We have, and I know Mr. Humphrey and also Mr. Johnson have talked about the fact that the property valuation system is currently going through a procurement process. And as I shared with you the other day, the numbers are changing on that project as well. And so we will continue to provide updates to DAS and LFO as that project moves forward.
I think this is you.
It is me. Thank you. So I will talk a little bit about some of the budget adjustments that as we have gone through and reconciled the governor's budget, we've identified that there are some things that were missed or that we need to adjust. So first, you've heard me talk about for the last couple weeks that we are doing some cleanup on the budget as far as especially other fund limitation that's either empty limitation or not in the right location. So we are going to be cleaning that up. The biggest cleanup, I think, for us is a senior property tax deferral program. So we have about $27 million of other fund, non-limited other fund limitation that we don't need any longer. We budget everything into an other fund limited category. So we're just cleaning that piece up as well as some of additional other fund limitation in business and property tax. We have asked to add back 6 senior property tax deferral positions that were approved in the September e-board. Those just got missed as part of the technical entry when they got approved in September. So we are asking LFO to have those added back. Also, as far as the corrections to debt service, since the governor's recommended budget has been published, we have received updated numbers from Capital Finance, and so we are working with LFO to get those numbers adjusted. But as Deputy Director Chris Cowson said, we did have some conversations with LFO and DAS CFO regarding our CSR project, and that debt service number is going to change yet again since we are going to be asking for a lower amount. Also, we are going to be doing a budget adjustment in elderly rental assistance. In the governor's budget, it's identified that there's a general fund transfer in the amount of $3.3 million. We're not sure how that error occurred, and so we want to get that cleaned up. As we also discussed, we are looking at adding an accounting manager, a permanent full-time position, for our current accounting manager to actually be placed in. Also, concluding conversations with LFO as early as yesterday, we were talking about we have a half-time fiscal analyst 2 position, and we have not filled that. It's really hard to fill those types of positions just on a part-time basis. So we have had conversations about the possibility of moving that up to a 1 permanent full-time position. We also are discussing adding positions in FTE to OAA. The first part of the conversation is really about relieving some of the double fills that we discussed earlier in the vacancy discussion. And so we're looking at 7 positions, 7 FTE to resolve the double fill issue that they have in OAA. However, that does not make that section whole. We would need actually another 7 positions to make that unit whole in order to do the collection work that they have been doing. I want to note that this discussion that I've been having with LFO is completely separate from the Senate Bill 89 discussion. This is really specific to current operational needs and not anything that's upcoming or new work. So that is all on the budget presentation. Are there any questions?
Senator Johnson.
On POP, and unfortunately I didn't write down the number, but the policy option package that included the $2 million to the state data center, the services and supplies, and the $1.8 to maintain the warranty for Gentex. let's start with the littler one, the Gentex $1.8. How long is that payment going to continue, and is this going to be an ongoing general fund requirement, or... what's the duration of the warranty? How's that work? That's question number one. And question number two goes back to my old friend, the data center. And I would like to know what the trend in your fees at the data center have been and what additional charges they're larding on to you to help run that broken place.
Chair Smith, I'm asking our CIO, Gary Johnson, to come up and help answer those questions.
Good afternoon, Chair Smith, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Gary Johnson. I'm the Chief Information Officer at our Department of Revenue.
Go ahead.
So I'll answer your question, if I may, Senator Smith, backwards. So with regard to ETS charges, the lopting on, so we get... we're not centrally assessed on those charges. We get a usage-based charge. Those rates are set by the CUB and by...
You're using so many acronyms. Sorry. That I'm a seasoned hand, and I don't know what you're saying.
My apologies.
I have no idea what our new colleagues think.
Sure. Senator Smith, Representative Smith, Co-Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, the Customer Utility Board... also known as the CUB, there are, I believe, 4 of them. One of them is specifically for ETS. That's the rate-setting body that we defer to. So we're actually charged based on our utilization of services with the data center. So to get specific in terms of what they're lopting onto us, quote-unquote,
Larding was the
Larding.
Word
my apologies. I'll get that right next time. It's actually uses-based. So we're getting charged based on whatever that rate is, based on whatever the CUB, the Customer Utility Board, set for that biennium.
And this is a result of your new core system? This is just
the charges? Yes, correct.
Was this, so I presume this is going to be an ongoing expense that you will turn to the general fund to fund forever and ever. Amen.
Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, yes. This is funding that will be necessary to support the servers and the systems that the Gentax software rides on.
Okay. I don't recall that discussion during the core replacement conversation, but if this is an ongoing responsibility of the general fund, that's interesting to know. So what's the situation with the warranty?
Co-Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, yes, there is, with any big software purchase, even smaller software purchases, there's typically what's called a maintenance agreement. Maintenance agreements typically run 20 to 30% of purchase price. So, yes, in order to get those updated service packs and upgrades and keep the system current, we would need some kind of ongoing warranty, quote unquote, for that product. That's not to say that we would necessarily have to operate at the highest level of Tier 3. Our hope, in fact, is that we can, at some point in the future, knowledge transfer and get our DOR FTE into a situation where they can maintain this mostly on their own. But in order to access even the service packs and the upgrades, that's an ongoing cost, and it's very standard in our industry.
Mr. Chair, I just don't recall from last committee's discussions. I know that you and the then-chair, Steiner Hayward, were very involved. Is this new news to you?
Yeah, it is. It is. Yeah.
Okay. Good. I'm glad that my memory is not so faulty, but I don't remember any discussion. So have you projected this out into a future biennial request? When you say that, I don't know whether the $1.8 million reflects being at the top tier. I don't know how seriously in the thrall of the vendor we are. Is that $1.8 a fixed price, or can it, you at least suggested that it might go up or down based on what tier we have. How vulnerable are we to the company should we not have general fund to support this 1.8? Or is this baked into a contract?
Co-Chair Manning, I assume now at this point. Senator Johnson, it is currently part of a contract that we have. That's not to say that at some point in the future that contract won't be renegotiated at an advantage to the state.
I'm sorry to keep whooping on this. Is there an opening? I mean, you said it could be negotiated. Could be if what happens. I mean, is there an opener in the contract 3 years from now, or is it a failure to them for them to perform? Our need goes up. How vulnerable are we to increases in that 1.8?
Co-Chair Manning, Senator Johnson. It's a pretty vetted contract. There's been a lot of legal sufficiency around this particular contract. I'm not exactly sure when this particular contract comes up for renewal. We can certainly get you that information. At that point in time, that's when we'd renegotiate the contract. We'd be potentially able to leverage our knowledge transfer and our comfort level with our supportability internally.
One last question. It doesn't appear to me, based on the comments that you have made, that there is any option but to fund policy option package 102. It appears we are contractually bound by the maintenance or the warranty agreement. And it appears to me that you have just said, okay, if the customer utility board says that's the price, that's the price. And I don't know where your data goes if we don't fund these. So I'm just curious, in the priority of things that you want that have general fund or that you need, Where do these two rate?
Co-Chair Manning, Senator Johnson, they would be at the top of the list in order to keep the $70 million investment that was just made up and running that is over 60% of the systems inside of our organization and affect over 700 employees.
That's what I was afraid you were going to say.
But Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, and Senator Johnson, I think it might be good for Mr. Johnson to, maybe review the tiers associated with that. This is the mid-level tier funding. There are two other options, a higher tier, more expensive tier, and a lower tier. And my understanding is what those represent are two things. One is upgrade of the system that has been put in, and the second is a level of support from the vendor that is based upon which tier of funding. So the bottom tier has no on-site people from the vendor, and then, of course, the top tier has plenty of folks there. I don't know if that's helpful, Senator Johnson.
It is.
And Senator, Co-Chair Manning, Senator Johnson, Mr. Borden's right on the money. The only addition I would add is there is the option of a tier zero, which I highly don't recommend.
I think that would be insane.
I concur.
But, colleagues, this raises a very important point, and that is when we're being asked to look at these giant IT systems, it isn't just that cost. It is the ongoing cost. Some of us inflicted to ourselves through my old friend the data center, some that are in contract where we don't have a choice. And I just think it's something that in our other committees we ought to be mindful of, because this was not abundantly obvious the last time around, and now it comes as a policy option package, as though there is any option at all, and there is not. And I object to the presentation.
Any other questions or comments from the committee? Mr. Co-Chair, did you want to share a final thought? Madam Director, I got to get this in order. Madam Director, come on up. You're coming up, I'm going to ask John to share a few thoughts. Then we'll go to Madam Director, and then Mr. Co-Chair, you and I can wrap up.
I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee. The governor's budget pursues a strategy here that is of note, because you will likely see something similar later on. That strategy is a reduction in positions to self-fund these significant IT investments. So I just wanted to make that note. The reductions in the governor's budget in order to do that, to fund these various priorities, was significant. About $18.9 million general fund reduction. So the current budget situation obviously is more of a zero-sum game, and so that has ramifications for large agencies like the Department of Revenue. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you. Representative Gomp,
you're good?
Yeah. Madam Director. Welcome.
Co-Chair Smith and Manning, members of the committee, I'm Nia Ray, Director of the Oregon Department of Revenue. And this has been a very enlightening and intense 2 weeks for me as a new director. And I have learned a lot about the process. I've even learned more about my department during the past 2 weeks. But more importantly, I certainly hope that you have a greater sense of who we are as a department and the needs we have as a department. Senator Johnson mentioned feeling a lack of urgency from the department, and I regret that we've conveyed that to you. But part of that may be because we know what we have to do. We've been instructed by this committee who has met with the governor's office. We are in planning stages. We're in planning mode because we want to get those answers to you, and we're satisfied that we're in that place. So, I apologize if we haven't shown you the courtesy and the respect of the urgency that these issues demand, but we are working on it. Finally, in the course of the 2 weeks, we've had, as I said, very intense discussion, very in-depth discussions about decisions that we've made as leaders These are leadership issues you have. And sometimes when our staff, the frontline staff, hears these discussions, they interpret it as a reflection on their competence and their ability. That is not the intention of any of the leadership staff that has communicated with you, and I don't believe that that's your intention either. The goal here is to ensure that management is making the type of decisions that reflect well on the state of Oregon. So with that, I congratulate my staff on coming to work every day and committing to the Department of Revenue the way that they do, and I, for one, am proud to lead them in their endeavors. And that ends my comments. Thank you, committee.
Thank you, Madam Director. Rep. Grumberg, did you want to share one last thought on them, Gay?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to thank the co-chairs, and I wanted to thank the department. It has been an illuminating 2 weeks, and I believe that that we have all worked together to identify constructively some issues that that need some attention. I'm also pleased that the governor's office has been monitoring our conversations here. And Mr. Co-Chair, I heard you say earlier today that you anticipated we'd be receiving some regular reports on progress on some of the issues that we have uncovered. If at times it seemed a little intense here, I had commented at one point that we want you to be successful. Senator Johnson retorted very quickly, we need you to be successful. I hope that there's a couple of things that come out of this that we might be able to pursue, Mr. Co-Chair. One of them is that these regular reports that we have talked about going forward into the interim, because we just can't wait until 2 years from now to sit down and revisit these questions. But I also hope that that we might be able to look at either some KPMs or a budget note that would help us identify progress, particularly on the delinquent debt question that that has been the focus of a lot of our conversation here, particularly in the context that if Senate Bill 89 advances through the process, that this department's going to be getting not only the $600 million that's currently in their portfolio, but a total of about $3.3 billion from throughout the entire state. So a lot of things going on here, and I appreciate the time we've taken to try and begin to scratch the surface.
Very, very thoughtful comments, Representative. Thank you. Mr. Co-Chair?
Senator Johnson, did you have anything else?
No, sir.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Director, the subcommittee co-chairs wish to express our thanks and gratitudes towards you and the agency and the employees for the last 2 weeks of presentations. As we have said many times throughout these hearings, subcommittee views the Department of Revenue as one of the most critical and crucial agencies in the state. The purpose of having 2 weeks of hearings was for this subcommittee to gain a better understanding of the various issues and challenges facing the department. After hearing the department's presentation, the subcommittee can now think about the testimonies provided and what subcommittee members feel is working and what improvements are needed. Subcommittee co-chairs are working closely with the department, Joint Ways and Means co-chairs, and the governor's office on a plan of action for the department. In general, the plan seeks to safeguard and improve the state's revenue-generating capability, improve collections, restore legislative budgetary controls to the department, improve financial management, improve and enhance customer service, seek an independent organizational review of agency operations, and to provide a period of stabilization until automation is fully operationalized. Subcommittee co-chairs would appreciate hearing directly from subcommittee members on what issues are important to you as this plan is being put together. To the employees of the Department of Revenue, we wish to express our thanks for gratitude for the work that you have done for our state. And we look forward to working with you as you continue to move through the challenges to make sure that you are strengthened and have the resources necessary to achieve the goals as outlined by statutory and expectations of the staff, subcommittee, and the governor. So with that, I want to thank you again for being here, co-chair. On behalf of LFO and those that are not even present here, we want to thank you very much. Mr. Co-Chair, anything else?
Thank you. No, I want to thank John for all of his hard work. He just does an A-plus job for each and every one of us in the legislature. And so well done. Madam Director, we look forward to working with you and your staff, and we're glad you're here. We really are. We're glad you're in Oregon. We're glad you're with the department, and we look forward to working closely with you.
Thank you.
And I do want to associate my comments with the co-chairs. So, colleagues, with that said, I think we're done for the day. Michael, anything we got to think about? We're good? All righty, then we're going to adjourn for the day.
Do we not have a meeting Monday or Tuesday?